If you think Robert Altman made a mess of the army in MASH, wait till you see what he does to the cops in Brewster McCloud.
What do you think we are down here, stupid?
We take you now to the Houston airport where super cop Frank Shaft has just arrived to work on the recent rash of mysterious strangulation murders.
Look at this stuff in his eye.
That's bird.
But I don't believe we could determine what kind of bird it came from.
Now, there's a killer loose in this city, Johnson. We're going to get him, or we're going to go downtown and play politics.
Brewster McCloud, the movie that has all the cops asking one question. Who is the Houston Strangler? Could it be Daphne Heap, longtime Houston socialite?
That's why I bought you these uniforms! Now!
What's the matter, honey? Your leg hurt?
God damn it! That's yours?
Could it be Douglas D. Green, longtime Houston narcotics agent?
Yeah. Breen. Narcotics.
Or is it 99-year-old Leonard Wright?
Don't you ever lay a hand on my money. Cloud.
Two, three, 12.
Okay, Jonathan, I see you.
Or maybe the Houston Strangler is the lovely Suzanne.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmony of liberty. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun for a new day. Our day has begun. Let's march on till victory is won.
Brewster McCloud, a young boy's heroic struggle against the combined forces of gravity and the Houston police.
Hello, and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and my pal Dan Budnick is back. Hi, Dan.
Ooh, Rob, I just dropped a steamer through the hoop. Oh, boy. Ooh. Oh, how you doing?
Good. It's a little unusual that we're having Dan back on the show so soon. Of course, he was on just a couple of weeks ago with the lovely Sarah Jane talking about the other Cinderella. But this time we're here to talk about a movie. This is something you and I have talked about doing for a couple of years now. But I was so determined to get to the, porn film that we pushed that ahead in line. But now we're here to talk about Robert Altman's 1970 movie, Brewster McCloud. And I have a lot of things to sort of say about this movie. I know this is one of your all-time favorite movies. But I do want to give a little bit for anybody who doesn't know kind of the context of this movie. I mean, yes, there is a nominal plot description on IMDb, which is an introverted loner. Guess who plays the introverted loner? Bud Cort. Living in the bowels of the Astrodome, plots to develop with the aid of a mysterious guardian angel a pair of wings that will help him fly. Now, this movie, I've seen this described in a bunch of reviews that I read online about it. About this is one of the most films that epitomizes the notion of a blank check for a director.
Why don't
for anyone who doesn't know what that is, Dan, why don't you describe exactly what that is and how this film fits into that sort of genre?
You will get on occasion, you will get a director who will make something that is so popular, that is so beloved, that a studio will basically say, do whatever you want. And the sometimes that's fine, but then sometimes you get someone like Robert Altman. So he obviously he made MASH, and MASH came out and surprised the heck out of everyone. It made a ton of money. Obviously, it brought forth a TV show that we all know and love, and it was nominated for all sorts of Academy Awards and things like that. And pretty much they said to Robert Altman, who had been working in television and doing some features since the late 50s, I think.
Something like that.
And he, and they said to him, make us a move, make us the next MASH. And if you watch the trailer for Brewster McCloud, it says that Brewster McCloud is for cops what MASH was for the Army.
That's completely not quite right. True.
And if you watch the trailer, even the trailer gives up on that about halfway through, because the trailer begins pretending like, who is the Houston Strangler? Is it this person? This person? The story of a young man who wants to fly. And suddenly, like, halfway through, it segues into closer to what the movie is about. And this is really every once in a while. Darn it, I should have written some examples down, because we will probably – I could probably think of some as we go. But you will find this happen throughout sort of the history of cinema, where you will get a director who's been directing and doing stuff. Then they do something that's a huge hit, and then they're just let free to do whatever they want. And they do something that makes everyone go, huh? That was Brewster McCloud.
Yeah, I couldn't said it. Could not have said it better myself. I mean, this film reunites several cast members from MASH. It's got Sally Kellerman, yes. G. Wood, Michael Murphy, Rene Auberjonois, Corey Fisher, John Shook. So he's front loading it, and of course Bud Cort, who was introduced in MASH. I mean, so you've got all these MASH people in it, but yet it is one of the most confounding movies I've ever seen. I saw this movie for the first time back when I worked at the video store, Movies Unlimited, and I watched it, and I could not make heads or tails of it. No pun intended. I just was like, I don't know what that was about, and I just put it aside. And then when I asked you about what movie did you want to talk about, and you brought this up, I thought, wow, that's an odd. Okay, let me watch this one again. And so I watched it again. I actually watched it twice more, I sort of hate admitting this, because I host a movie podcast and I feel like I should have some facility at analyzing the films that I'm here to talk about. But I have no idea what this movie – I have no idea what Altman is trying to tell me or what he's trying to say about this movie. I mean, for anyone who hasn't seen it, I mean, I was about to say I'm going to spoil the ending, but you really can't spoil this movie. That's not what it's about. It's not about the plot.
No, yeah.
It's about the mood. Mm-hmm. This is a movie that opens up with Margaret Hamilton, yes, the Wicked Witch of the West, in the middle of the Houston Astrodome singing the national anthem. And when she realizes that what she is singing is off key, she tells the band to start over in another key. And at that point, the movie's credits start all over again. You get Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer presents twice. You get Brewster McCloud twice. You get a film by Robert Altman twice.
Yes.
Then this movie ends with the cast. Again, the aforementioned Bud Cort, Sally Kellerman, Michael Murphy, William Wyndham, Shelley Duvall, whose first film this is,
yes,
Stacey Keach,
yes,
Rene Auberjonois, John Shook, Margaret Hamilton, Jennifer Salt, Corey Fisher, all coming out in clown in circus gear. Meanwhile, the main character, Brewster McCloud, lays dead on the floor of the Astrodome. So it's that kind of movie. And am I running the risk here of trying to see more here than is really here? Could it be that Altman is just making this kind of like hippy dippy thing that's meant to be watched while you're halfway stoned? I mean, please, Dan, guide me through this.
Okay, all right.
Well,
I'm just going to start with I can guide us about 60% of the way through. There is I will just say this, and why I won't try to go all the way through, because there is a lecturer throughout the movie, Rene Auberjonois,
right. Yes.
Who shows up every once in a while and relates the main characters to birds. It's a very ornithological film. I'll mention my other favorite ornithological film when we get near the end. It ain't Birdemic, folks. All right. So I'll just keep you on that.
I'll write that down.
But Yeah. But he, René Auberjonois shows up throughout, and the movie is framed as sort of a lecture that's being given about the human nature and humanity. And as it goes on, the person who is giving the lecture turns into a bird. I don't know what that means, but it's awesome. And there is a point where he says, for the next hour or so, we are going to talk about this subject. And I hope that more or less he says something like, I hope that we draw no conclusion. I've got it here. Elsewise, the subject shall cease to fascinate us. And alas, another dream will be lost. There are far too few. And I think that's part of what's going on. Now, I think what I have read is that the original script written by Doran William Cannon, I believe that's his name, who I only know of from one other film. And I'm sorry, Rob, I didn't look it up, but his name is on one other film. His original script was something like, it was like Brewster McCloud's Crazy Phantasmagoria or something like that. And I think it was very much like a super like hippie. I was going to use the term hippy dippy, so I'm glad you did. I think it was very much like that. And Robert Altman made it more to his way. I mean, he was already what, like in his 80s or something. How old was he when he made this? I don't know. He was always seemed like an older guy.
He always
to me,
seemed
but
like
he
an older
was,
guy. Yeah. No, I mean, I guess he was probably in his 40s. Yeah. I mean, but yeah.
I think so. So to me, this isn't. I never see this film, because there are a lot of films at the end of the 60s and the start of the 70s that you need to sit and just get completely baked and watch. I don't feel, even though Lou Adler, who directed Up in Smoke, produced this, I don't think this is fully that kind of film. I think here, okay, let me give you, here we go. Let me give you here is the very basic premise that I think is happening with Brewster, and then we can talk about the other characters.
Okay, fair enough. Now, I'm really happy that you're having such trouble with this, because now I don't feel so bad.
No, I have a through line, and part of it you have to remember, like you mentioned, Margaret Hamilton says started again, and we actually cut to the camera in its original first position going up to the roof of the Astrodome, repositioning itself, and the credits start again. And when you see the MGM lion at the beginning of the movie, there's no roar. You just hear René Auberjonois say, he says, I forgot my opening line. And you hear people laughing. You don't hear any other people during the lecture, but that moment you hear people. So there's something – he's up to something. Pauline Kael, by the way, who's one of my favorite reviewers of all time, loved MASH. She loved McCabe and Mrs. Miller. She didn't like Brewster McCloud. She thought it was kind of a fart of a film. But she would only go to see films once. And I think this film, you really need to see it more than once. Maybe – 11 times? No, I'm kidding, but I'd probably watch it that many times. So here's what I'll tell you. Brewster, now, okay, Fire and Water, you guys have a motto, and your motto is find your joy.
Find
correct?
Your joy, right, yes.
Yes, find your joy. And find your joy is, and did Shag come up with that, or was that, I feel like, was that a Shag thing? Or if it was you, Rob, I apologize.
I don't know exactly who, it might have been Ryan, actually. I think we sort of stumbled upon it, but
really?
I feel like Ryan was the first one to sort of, like, coin it in those words in that order, I think.
Okay. And that's, I think, to me, that is a wonderful, that's one of the reasons why I been a fan of the Fire and Water Network since you started and before that, because of that. And to me, there's another tier of that, and that's the Joseph Campbell tier of find your joy, follow your bliss. I got lost in the words there. And that's it. During The Power of Myth, when Joseph Campbell is talking with Bill Moyers, he says, follow your bliss, find your bliss. And that's basically, you know, you have in your mind your dream, whatever it is, and you need to follow it. You need to follow it down. And if you follow it and you stay true to it, what he describes is like doors will open that you didn't realize were there, and opportunities will present themselves that you never expected if you just stay true to whatever your dream is, whatever your heart and soul, as it were, is after. Now, that could be, you want to be a chef, you want to be a writer, you want to be a plumber. I don't know, whatever you want to do, that's what it is. And to me, the Brewster McCloud is a metaphor, and it's obviously, maybe not obviously, but Brewster is this guy who lives in a fallout shelter in the Houston Astrodome. And although people seem to see him when he goes out of the fallout shelter, they can't seem to follow him in unless they want him to. And when he's in the fallout shelter, he is building, he is exercising his muscles so he can fly with wings that he's building so he can fly away from the earth. It's never said specifically where he's going. It's never said where he's come from. But he's going to fly away. And to me, the moment he doesn't actually say that until like 38 or 39 minutes into the film, which was weird. I thought that was earlier in the movie. But that's what he's going to do. And because he's following this dream, and I know what you're thinking, Dan, you should break in a little bit of Elvis, sing and follow that dream. No, I'm not going to, Rob. You always want me to sing. And I'm not going to do that. But because he's following that dream, he has a guardian angel, Louise, Sally Kellerman.
Right.
Sally Kellerman has a is it a familiar, the Raven? Is that what you would call it? Sort of someone who – a bird who sees through her she sees through a bird's eyes, a raven. And the raven follows Brewster around wherever he goes. And when he's in trouble, when something he wants to do, for example, there's a very funny scene where he needs a camera and he meets a great guy named Gary and some other people. And he basically but he goes in and he asks for a camera with a huge telephoto lens. This guy behind the counter at this camera shop gives him this camera. He's got the camera around his neck. Suddenly, Louise, his guardian angel, appears and starts talking to this guy, Gary. And then Louise is seen to shoplift and there's craziness going on. And as they're going through Louise's purse, Brewster just walks out of the store with this hugely expensive camera and no one sees him. Now, I know what you're saying, Dan, you recommend shoplifting in order to achieve your dreams. That's one of the things about the movie. We'll get to that. Let's treat it as a metaphor and just follow it down for the moment. So what happens is, as long as he follows his dream, or his follows the bliss, as it were, he has this guardian angel who will watch over him and protect him. And he has people like Hope, Jennifer Salt's character, who will show up like once a week with a huge bag of food for him. She doesn't seem to know quite why she's doing it, but she's there providing him with food. And there he's able to do all this stuff as long as he stays true to his dream and his goal. And the thing about the movie is that as the movie goes along, he is warned by Louise that you can't let the outside things, specifically sex, in this movie. I don't think they're saying like have sex and die. This isn't like a slasher film. I think sex is just what they used here. But specifically, you know, Louise is saying don't get involved with people. Don't, because Brewster's a virgin. Don't get involved with people. Don't do this because that will take you away from what your focus is. You need to build your wings and you need to leave. And the thing is, as the movie goes along, he gets involved with a very nice-looking Shelley Duvall. And
oh, she's beautiful in this movie. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Yes, I know. It's tough. But he gets involved with her. And then, I mean, we're completely spoiling the whole movie. But the moment he gets involved with her, he does that thing where, I don't know, like during like high school, I had like three or four really good friends, a mix of guys and a couple gals. And we were just like, we were so close. And it was like, we were like, it was like back streets, you know, we were on the back streets together and we were just, oh, dun, 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 you know, we were just going to do it. But then like the moment near the end of high school, when one of us got a girlfriend or a boyfriend, it was like, where's Jen? Oh, she's with Steve. Okay. And then we rarely saw her again, you know, and where's Nick? It's with Rachel, right? And that's kind of what happens here is the moment Brewster has sex with oh gosh, what's her, is it Suzanne? I forget what her character's name is, Shelley Duvall's character.
Hope is Jennifer Salt. Suzanne, yeah.
Yes.
She's the tour guide for the Houston Astros.
Yes, and we could talk about how funny that is. It's interesting because Brewster doesn't see Hope as a sexual object, although she is as sexy as Shelley Duvall is. But for some reason, I think like Shelley, he just goes after Shelley Duvall's character and they have sex. And the moment he does, he goes back to work on his wings. And Louise, the guardian angel, is like, you had sex, didn't you? Yep. And it was great. I don't know why you're, you know, bad mouthing it, Louise, because you need to keep your focus, Brewster. You need to keep the focus. And he's like, whatever. I've invited her down here and I've told her everything, you know, and it's just, and then everything falls apart. And I'm going to call that a metaphor because it's very much, you need to focus. When you focus on your dream, you need to go all in. And the moment you start to wander and like, okay, I'll go away from it for a while and go over here and go over there. Then you're sort of, your wall begins to, not like a Pink Floyd wall, kind of like a Pink Floyd wall, begins to crumble and begins to fall apart. And then eventually in the movie, Louise is like, she leaves him. And the moment she leaves him, he dies. And to me, that's what his part of the movie is about. It's about, and I think it could have been Robert Altman, maybe after all those years in television, being at a point where he was like, wait a minute, they just told me I could do whatever I wanted. And so he's like, oh, my gosh, okay. And he's telling a story about someone who has the ability to do what they want but gets pulled aside by, like, earthly junk. Well, sex is fun, you know, but you know what I mean. You know what I mean. You know, it's like the – it doesn't have to be sex, like I said. It can be something.
Right.
Because she also mentions, like, the moment he says, I built wings, her first thing is, we got to get you a lawyer. You're going to be a millionaire. So it's power. It's wealth. It's sex. It's all these distractions that keep you from the path you're on. And we might almost say the Wizard of Oz things, it takes you off the road. The moment you get off the yellow brick road, you're screwed, you know, and that's what happens to Brewster. And he gets screwed, and then he properly gets screwed by dying. So to me, that is, and pardon me, it's an R-rated movie, folks. But to me, that's Brewster's portion of the story. We can talk about the 1,400 other characters if you would like.
Perfect. All right. Right. That's a perfect thing. There's so much I need to respond to this. Okay. First of all, the camera shop scene. I'm glad you mentioned the camera shop scene because, again, as I was watching this movie and I'm you know, like, okay, I'm trying to get a handle on, like, what this world is. Is it a real world? Is it kind of – I mean, obviously it's sort of hyper-stylized because we've – again, you mentioned you've got Aubergenois doing this lecture and you got the – you know, the film starts over. But, like, in that scene where Louise steals all the camera stuff and we see it in her purse. Like, she's clearly putting it all in her purse. And the guy at the camera shop sees that. And then she walks away and he goes, excuse me, ma'am. And he chases her to the doorway and he opens her purse and she starts pointing and none of the stuff is in there. And I'm like, okay, yes. Wait a minute. I know you saw the film go in there. And by the way, the film is edited, at no point did she dump it out. And so I'm like, okay, we are now in this film looks real. It looks like a real world. It's shot like it's a real – I mean, it kind of – you know, it has that Altman look. It doesn't look like a cartoon. But clearly we are in a fantasy world because something magical just happened because we know that she stole the film and the guy knows he stole the film, but yet the film is gone. I'm like, okay, so now we are in some sort of world where not where the laws of reality don't necessarily follow. So, okay, I had that part. And all the stuff about Bud Cord being the you know, staying on the path and all this stuff, because as you mentioned, there's a lot of Wizard of Oz references. I mentioned Margaret Hamilton, who played the Wicked Witch of the West. She literally wears ruby slippers at one point in this movie.
Yes.
Jennifer Salt dresses as Dorothy at one point and literally carries around Toto with her. But then there's all this other stuff, and you've got Michael Murphy playing a detective, Lieutenant Frank Shaft, before there was even a Shaft movie. Yes. But he's dressed like Bullet. He's named Shaft, but he's dressed like Bullet from Steve McQueen. And then you've got Stacy Keach in old age makeup as this this rich guy in the wheelchair. You've got John Shuck as kind of the dumb cop. And it's all this other stuff because there's this murder mystery going on. And all the victims end up with bird crap on their faces. So it's like every time the movie veered into – all the time, every time it veers away from Brewster and goes into this other stuff, I just was like, what's happening?
Yeah. I mean, all I can think of with some of it is it's just showing different areas of, I guess, like the human condition. Like John Shuck is this kind of big, dumb guy who has – I don't even know why this – how this makes sense, but like there's a scene where John Shuck is at home with his family and you see his wife, who's a kind of a tiny woman, and he has six kids and three sets of twins, and they're all boys. And it's like, I don't know what that means. And there are other things. I mean, this is one of those movies where you either just let it all wash over you and just you can come back to it when you want and absorb it, or you can sit there and go, okay, what did that mean? Like there's a moment where Shaft is in his hotel room, right, and he's putting on his holster and he's matching up all his turtlenecks and he's looking really good, and you hear ambulances going by, and they look out the window, and Shaft is like, how do you get any sleep or rest around here? Oh yeah, those are the heart guys. What are you talking about? Well, we have a bunch of guys who do heart transplants, and whenever someone dies, you know, they take care of it. And it's like, what does that mean? Why the heart, is that like, so they got a Houston thing? I've only been to Houston once, and I wasn't there long enough to, you know, gauge. Is it a big heart town? Do you go there for a heart transplant? I don't know. But it's just like, I think you can either look at every moment and go, okay, that means something. Or you can just say it's craziness or of some sort. But I love – I mean, my favorite character – well, I don't know if he's my favorite character. I love Stacy Keach in this movie so very much.
Who's unrecognizable. When I watched this movie, I did not know who that was, and I kept waiting for Stacy Keach to show up. It's like it took me till the end. I went, wait, that's Stacy Keach.
Oh, and it's such he plays Abraham Wright, who is like, according to the trailer, which calls him Leonard Wright, he's 99 years old. And the joy of this is that he plays a super old guy, and Brewster is taking him on rounds to collect money from nursing homes that he owns. And Abraham is just rude and racist and homophobic and just he's hilarious. It's just like, and you know what? Can I just say something, Rob? I would just like to stop talking about the movie for a minute and ask you, how many episodes of Film and Water have you done?
This will be 160, I guess.
And has anyone ever told you that you have a beautiful Doremus?
Not on air, Dan.
Yes. Okay. I just said it, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Because Abraham is gross, and he's grabbing women's behinds. And at one point he reaches down in the front of an old woman's dress and pulls money out of there. And he ends up getting strangled and dying in a really wonderful shot where you see his limo coming down the street, and then the limo goes like in one direction and you see his wheelchair has been behind it on the street the whole time. And I just love that character. And the great thing about it is you watch the scene with his character and you think, what's this about? Why is this scene happening? And then when you learn why it's happening, it's so cool. I think it's cool. I don't know. Did you think it was cool at all, Rob? Or did you just say, what is happening now?
That's the thing, is that I just, for so much of this movie, I just was like, what is happening? I just like, just baffled by it. And again, I mean, I've seen enough movies now to know that there are some movies that are not meant to be taken in on a literal sense. You know what I mean? Like, they're just meant to be experienced.
Yeah.
I mean, just, in fact, just last week, I talked about Burial Ground, which, you know, has a plot.
Oh, sure.
Right. You're going through with it a minute at a time. And you know, that's one of those movies that's really just meant to be experienced. It's not meant to worry about the plot,
yes,
because there is no plot. It's a bunch of zombies attack, and that's the end of the movie. And when I see a movie like this, I start to wonder, and this triggers my deep insecurity about myself as a person, and that's my own that's my own issues. But like, when I see a movie like this, and I see all these actors, right, and you've got Burt Remsen, the great Burt Remsen, as this, you know, another racist cop, and you've got, again, Stacy Keach at the height of his popularity in the old age makeup, and I think to myself, are all these actors in on it? Like, they all get it? Do they all understand what the piece is? Or are a lot of actors just so happy to be working that they just are like, all right, Bob, I'll just do it.
Sure,
you know, Stacy Keach is like, you want me to wear old age makeup? Great. You're the hippest thing in Hollywood right now. John Shuck's like, do you want me to read some Captain America comics in the front seat of my squad car and laugh like an idiot? I'll go right ahead, Bob. Yeah. Sure, whatever you want. Am I giving actors too much credit? Like, I mean, surely some of them understood the themes of this, but there must have been some of them that were just like, I don't know what he was having me do, but I did it because I'm an actor and I want to work.
Yeah.
I mean, and like I said, it's one of these, like, I don't want to say that I didn't enjoy the movie, because I did, but it is one of those things where I felt frustrated in that I'm just like, what is Altman trying to tell me? And I just don't get it. And I felt dumb that I couldn't get it. And even after I read a bunch of reviews, I still was like, I don't know. I mean, it's like, okay, I get, you know, it's like, okay, he's good. He's a bird. He wants to fly. He wants to be free. And of course, where does he set himself off?
Yeah.
In the Astrodome, like one of the few ballparks that has a roof. So, I mean, he's the ultimate bird, you know? And it's like, okay, I get that part of it. But so much, and it reminded me a lot, actually, of a Coen Brothers movie, where you have these sort of weird characters that kind of enter into your story, and they just sort of bounce off one another. And each of the individual characters are only kind of caring about their specific thing. I mean, like, after Brewster and Suzanne go on that drive, Brewster gets accosted by Suzanne's ostensible boyfriend, who's like, you know, hey, you worrying about, you know, you getting in on my girl. And he beats Brewster up, or he tries to. And it's like, that guy is completely unconcerned with what's going on around him. He just has this one thing to do. And that reminded me very much of a Coen Brothers movie, where those characters enter in, they bounce off each other, and then they disappear. And part of it is, I guess, you're just trying to put across that chaos. I mean, that's part of the thing that appeals to you, and that's why you love this movie so much.
That could be. I one of the things I always forget about the movie when I watch it is that it actually kind of moves from sort of piece to piece pretty well. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, like the stuff with the guy and the car, you know, like the way Brewster is found out is through this car that Suzanne has that was stolen, that the boyfriend is there, you know, and it's actually, the plot is worked out fairly decently. The very basic plot, as in we're trying to find a killer, is actually worked out pretty good. I mean, it begins with a lot of discussion about bird poop. But then that kind of becomes a bit of a dead end. But then it's like they're suddenly all out looking for this, what is it, the 1970 Mango Roadrunner killer has. And they is. And then we get a huge car chase, and then it's all, you know, and then gradually it kind of becomes it kind of moves towards its ending. And I was like even with the Abraham Wright thing, like when I first watched that sequence, I was in hysterics. I thought Stacey Keach was just wonderfully hysterical in that scene, but I didn't know why I was watching it. I didn't know what it meant. But then you learn what it meant, and you what it means, what it meant, what it means. And that's in probably the scene that I laugh at the most, which is the scene where Frank Shaft interviews Milhouse, Abraham Wright's like butler or something, and right. They have the discussion where he's standing on the steps, and it's like, and I won't, you guys got to watch it, but it's a scene that always makes me laugh so much. And at the end of the scene, you get the whole meaning behind this last 10 minutes, which is like this Milhouse pointing at an empty case saying, and this guy came back, Brewster, and he stole this book that Mr. Wright's brothers gave to him. And then it cuts to Brewster opening the book, and it's a book on flight written by Wilbur and Orville Wright. And it's like, oh, okay, so that's what all this meant. And so things at a very basic plot level kind of make sense. The problem is it's almost like a Mad Magazine kind of thing where like they throw like 100 faces at you and like each panel has like 10 big word balloons and you're trying to maneuver your way through them all.
Right.
And it keeps cutting to like Renee Auberjonois becoming more and more of a bird. And you get, you know, these, and here's the thing. I would say to everyone, please, whatever your dream is, whatever you're after, please follow that down. However, if your guardian angel begins to strangle people in order for you to achieve that, you need to maybe find another route. Because that's the one thing about the film. That's one of the things about the films that always confuses me is I get what that is. I get that she is there, Louise, the guardian angel, is there to protect him at all costs. But she strangles people. She's killing people. And even like in the end, they don't show it, but I think they kill the John Shuck character, don't they? Because he gets pooped on.
Yeah,
and that's the last time we see him.
There's a lot of that. And as you said, there's a lot of that. And Bert Remsen gets pooped on, and there's the bird,
yes.
The bird sanctuary run by Margaret Hamilton gets pooped on, and she gets pooped on. I mean,
yes.
There's a lot of slapstick. I mean, you mentioned the scene with Stacey Keach, where he's in his wheelchair and the wheelchair spins out of control, and that is as slapstick as anything you would have seen in a Three Stooges short or anything. And
yes.
There's some part of me that's like, I can't believe that this artiste. You know, this one of the great filmmakers of the latter half of the 20th century, Robert Altman, is doing this kind of like lowbrow stuff. And I guess it's not so much lowbrow, but it's something you're not used to seeing in this kind of movie by Robert Altman, I guess.
I think, yeah, to me, it's sort of like unexpected. You don't expect to see that. I think sort of at the end, and there are a lot of other great characters in there too. I mean, there's the who's the main cop and his sidekick Haynes. I forget what his name is.
Right, G. Wood from MASH is Captain Crandall, and they kind of follow them down a road a little because there's a whole bunch of kind of like territoriality between him and Frank Shaft, because of course Frank Shaft is kind of like the pro from Dover coming in and kind of taking over the investigation. And when you mentioned he first shows up in the hotel room, we see in his suitcase are nothing but turtlenecks. That's all he's brought with him are turtlenecks.
Yes.
And I mean, again, it's like, I can't think of too many movies in 1971 that were so openly parodying another movie that had just come out like 2 years earlier. Like that's by itself is just surreal. I mean, how in your mind, how is Altman's style, as you would – I mean, a lot of people think Robert Altman's first film is M.A.S.H., and it's not. He actually directed, I think, three or four movies before he got to M.A.S.H. It's M.A.S.H. where the style really delivered itself, and he became Robert Altman, all caps kind of. But it's there's a similar style in terms of he's pointing the camera at this sort of just this bunch of scenarios, and he's sort of just letting your eye just sort of drift around,
yeah.
and as you talked about, like almost like a Mad Magazine, like you're just seeing all the little nooks and crannies of this world. And in MASH, it's a lot easier, mm-hmm. I'd say, to follow because you're so localized in that it's just at the camp. So you're like, okay, everybody, we're yes. seeing everybody at the 477. But of course, here he's spreading all around Houston. And so you've got the stuff with the cops,
yes.
you've got the stuff with Frank Schaff, you've got stuff with Brewster, you've got stuff with Louise. And so in your mind, is it kind of just it's a similar approach? He's just simply spreading the story out further? Is that what makes it kind of more accessible to you?
I think so, yeah. I think unlike, say, in some ways, MASH or Nashville, which is one of my favorites of his, or like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, or like California Split, like a lot of them from around this time, to me, those are more real films. So like in Nashville, that's a series of like events, like
right.
parties, recording sessions, concerts, pileups on the highway where everything happens. And there isn't – the joy of them is that there are plot lines and there are through lines, but it's not really about that. It's
right,
about
right.
the characters and all this stuff. Whereas Brewster, to me, has a very strong, in a way, plot line, whether it be who's the strangler or Brewster trying to get his wings going. And it makes for a very different viewing experience because he's doing the same technique but with – storyline, with a stronger storyline, which goes from like a beginning, middle to an end. Like MASH, I love MASH, but I if I remember correctly, I don't remember it having a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's a series of more like vignettes. I haven't watched it in a year or so. I
yeah,
apologize.
I mean,
I'm wrong.
It has a loose sense in that the film starts with the arrival of Hawkeye Duke Forrest, and it ends with them leaving. I mean, that's about as much of a through line as you get in that movie.
And I think with Brewster, I like it so much because it is who's the strangler? We called in this cop. We have to find out who's killing all these people. And there's something about that. I don't know that it really focuses all the strange scenes because there's so much going on. I mean, things like the funeral sequence where the horrible racist cop is being eulogized and they're reading, "How do I love thee? Let me count the ways." And then the moment the priest begins to read it, it starts raining and all the ink begins to run on the page.
Right, right.
And his wife who hated him just has this smile on her face the whole time. And it's there's that actually is preceded by the scene where Brewster Louise gives Brewster a bath, and they talk about what's going on, and then it fades into a song through the sky and you see the clouds, and then all of a sudden like he does this thing where like everything's spinning and going crazy, and suddenly you get a different version of the song that's more elegiac, more funeral like at the funeral, although the funeral is for a jerk. So I just love the fact that this is like this to me. First off, to me, this is a very funny film. This film makes me laugh a lot. And, It's also because it has – Brewster is working towards something and the cops are working towards something. I think it has a sort of impetus that pushes it forward in a way that some of his other films – like I love McCabe and Mrs. Miller. But when I sit there and I watch it, I guess with the snow coming down and the performances, it's I don't feel relaxed. What is the word I'm looking for when I watch it? I really get into that world, but there's rarely a sense of like in Brewster where like every few minutes sort of something happens where I'm like, where am I now? What's going
right.
on now?
Yeah.
Which I really like, which doesn't happen in a lot of his other films. And I'm not denigrating, you know, the films of his that everyone loves and saying that Brewster is his best film. Because I love Nashville. That's one of my favorites. Shortcuts is also one of my favorites. Quintet. No, I'm kidding. I don't. But Quintet is okay. Quintet has its charms.
OC and Stigs.
I just. Oh, see, you know what? When I saw this on the big screen, they double featured it with O.C. and Stiggs.
Very nice.
That was a very interesting double feature. But yeah, may I bring up something that I noticed when I watched it this afternoon that I never quite thought of before?
Of course.
So you get Brewster, and he's wandering into these situations, and Louise or the Raven are always there to keep an eye on him. And this is a side thing. We see Hope twice, Jennifer Salt's character. I love Jennifer Salt. She was in Sisters, of course, right. A film I adore. Yes. And the first time you see her, she is with talking to Brewster and getting very excited in an orgasmic fashion.
Right, and there's one scene,
my wife always walks in the room when I'm watching this movie when Bud Cort's behind is in the foreground and he's doing his pull-ups and she's in the background. And my wife always stops and goes, Bud Cort, yeah. And so, yeah, okay. Babe.
Wow.
But the second time Hope appears, the scene is played as if she thinks Brewster is there, but Brewster isn't there. It's Louise. And you never get a moment in the scene where Hope looks at Louise and goes, "You're not Brewster." She just acts like he is. And I'm wondering, what do you think that means, Rob? Is that too much? Did I blow your mind?
You know, that was one of those scenes that just left me like, okay, you know, all right, I'm just accepting this as it rolls on. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I thought it was probably since she would only sort of appear when she needed to appear, and she is being his guardian angel. She would kind of, when he wasn't there, she could sort of manifest as him, sort of. You know, then his next film was McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which is a really harsh film set in the snow with Warren Beatty, and it's crazy. So this is another thing. So let me just say this one knows this time. So one of the super sort of Mad Magazine scenes is they're at the scatologist's lab, and the guy is looking through the microscope at the bird poop. And there are like 10 people, maybe even more than that. But there are so many characters in the room, and they're all sort of talking at once, and there's all this stuff going on. And the whole time this is happening, there is this guy with jail on the back of his shirt wandering back and forth. So you get the main characters actually trying to advance the story. And you get this one guy wandering around. At the end of the scene, everyone gets up and leaves. You see this guy with jail on his back grab a bunch of the marijuana cigarettes off a table and kind of go to put them in his pocket. He drops one. As John Chuck's character is leaving, he sees it, picks it up, hands it to the guy. The guy takes it, looks around, shrugs, puts it in his pocket, and walks away. Now, he walks in the opposite direction of everyone else, so there must have been another exit from the room. But the thing I think about that scene – here's what I thought today when I was watching this. If you watch that scene about 3 or 4 feet away from him, there are 3 cops and a woman in a lab coat talking very animatedly, and none of them see him grab the pot, put it in his pocket, get handed the cigarette, put that in his pocket, and leave. I think that woman is his guardian angel distracting the 3 cops from seeing him take all the pot.
Wow.
I think he is having his – and the reason why I can say that is because, as I mentioned before, the movie was produced by Lou Adler, who made Up in Smoke. So I think this guy's dream is to smoke as much pot as he can. And they don't have to be good dreams. I didn't say they had to be good dreams. They just have to be dreams. You can get angels from north and south. And so he walks away with a pocket full of pot, and he's going to smoke it. Now, the thing is, the foreshadowing that Brewster is going to fail is that as we're finding out about the 1970 Mango Roadrunner and the car chase is happening and all this crazy stuff is going on, there's a scene where we see very briefly two cops leading that guy into a squad car and driving away with him. So I think he must have at some point denied his guardian angel as Brewster did his and was abandoned. And so I think that is showing, one, that there are other people going through the same journey Brewster is, and two, you can be forsaken if you don't follow what your dream. So that's – put that down. I don't know. Write that down. The jail guy. I don't know what his name is. We'll call him Ron.
That's wow. See, now this is – right. See, now this is why I wanted to talk with you about this, because you were so – you were so vociferous about wanting to do this one. And I will admit, I think part of the reason I kept you at arm's length with this for a little while is because I knew this film was so impenetrable to me. And I was like, I don't know if I want to talk about a movie on a podcast where I don't understand much of what's going on. But you're also giving me keys to kind of work my way into this. I mean, because now that you're telling me this stuff, I'm kind of like, all right, I see what you're talking about. Okay, yeah, I understand that. And I mean, I must have read half a dozen articles about this film after it was over, and none of you have done more to give me a key into this film in the 45 minutes we've been talking than all those articles. So, I mean, I appreciate that, because that was what I wanted. Because, I mean, when I watch this movie, one of the things I think about, and forgive me if I go a little far afield here, because it doesn't seem to be an immediate connection, is John Carpenter. Right. Obviously, you don't think there's really much connection between Robert Altman and John Carpenter other than iconoclastic directors. But in the commentary for The Thing, Carpenter talks about what it's like to make a movie with studio backing, but then they leave you alone. And he said he was very specific. He said there is nothing better. There is nothing better in the world of making movies than being left alone, but knowing that the studio has your back, and knowing if you need the money to do this or that, they've got it. You don't have to scribe. You don't have to fight. You don't have to like sell your car. You can just call the studio and say, I need, you know what I mean? And there's something about this movie that it's beautiful to look at. It's so rich. It has so much going on. And it could just – there is a joy to it that, like I said, even though I find this movie, again, still very, very difficult to understand, there is a joy to it because you get the sense that this is Robert Altman unleashed. You know, I mean, we talked about at the beginning of the show. This is – he made MASH. No one had any expectations for that movie to go anywhere. He made it for nothing. Famously, 20th Century Fox, which of course is just now officially part of Disney, was spending all of its efforts and all of its money on Patton. And they were like off to the side. There were a bunch of hippies making this other thing. And then, you know, MASH became this monster hit. And so they just said, make whatever you want. And this is what he does with that money. And there's a joy to it that is very fun to watch. I mean, find your joy, you know? I mean, there's something very enjoyable about watching a guy just unleashed here. And this is kind of Robert Altman unleashed in a lot of ways. And that's what makes me want to kind of revisit this, especially after talking to you, because I feel like, okay, there's more here to unlock than I've been able to get to this point.
I almost I don't know if this is a proper spot in his career to say this also, but I almost think like in the early 90s he did The Player, which did really quite well after a few years of being a little off. And then he did Shortcuts, which is one of my favorite films of his. And to me, like Shortcuts is clearly Brewster and Shortcuts are made by the same person, but Brewster being based on the Raymond Carver stuff rather than some strange hippie script is a different sort of thing. But they're very much in the same space. And you can see with Shortcuts, I think, like he's just like, I want to – how many Raymond Carver stories do you want to use? 10. No, 15, 20. I don't know. Let's use them all. And they're all in there. And it's incredible. And Brewster to me is like, I want to do this. I want to do that. And I want to have a joke where like they find a marijuana cigarette at the scene of a crime, and they hand it to a cop, and two cops look at it and go, is that pot? There's only one way to find out. The other one shrugs, pulls out a lighter, leans in, and the first one says, "We got to take it to the lab." And the other one kind of goes, "Okay," and puts it back in its place. You know, it's jokes like that. I know 4,000 years old. There's probably a hieroglyph somewhere that has a similar joke about tobacco or something like that. But it's so fun to see, to me, something like that. And I think. This is one of those movies that I'm never going to fully understand. I mean, for example, like I love Shelley Duvall's character in this. When she's driving the car during the car chase, she is kick ass. And the look Brewster gives her is the look I would have given her. Like he's giving her a look like, oh my God. Oh, it's just because she puts on the leather gloves and she just goes wild.
She's luminous in this movie. And, unbelievable when I read about that she did not even intend to be an actress. She tried to sell somebody on the crew, like her paintings or something. I think that's how they got in the. And Altman saw her and went, "Oh my God, I got to put her in the movie. Look at this girl." And of course, he gave her a huge part. But I mean, he went on to use her probably more effectively than any other director. He put her in like five or six of his movies.
Yeah. And the great thing about her is her character is just like, she's such a silly character. Like she leads the tours through the Astrodome, and she has this, little PA system on her belt. And what's great is that she's got like 30 people around her going through the Astrodome. She's saying like, they have computers that run everything, and you can't understand what she's. And it's great because on the Blu-ray, even the person transcribing the movie for subtitles gives up at least one point when she's talking about the computers. It says, "I'm like, I met a guy the other day who ran the computers indistinct." So there you go. She's great, and she's like. And she's just got these moments where it's like where Brewster like tries to steal her car and he points at the Virgin Mary she has on the dashboard and says, right. "Oh, my car has one of those." She goes, "Yeah, that's the Virgin Mary. She was pretty popular at one time." And it's like, did you see what poster she has on her wall?
Oh, shoot. What is it? I know I saw it, but what is it? I'm forgetting it now.
She has a MASH poster on her wall.
Of course. All right. Yeah.
Of course. and she's great. And the thing is, like, here's the thing. Like, if I were Brewster, faced with Jennifer Salt and Shelley Duvall in this movie, I would have had a rough time following my guardian angel's rules. She's great. And I – one of my favorite moments in here – And I don't know what you think of this because I know in McCabe and Mrs. Miller we had some kick-ass Leonard Cohen songs.
Yes.
In this one we have I forget the guy's name. We have a woman who sings two songs, Lift Every Voice and Sing over the opening credits, and then White Feathered Wings, which is sort of the bird-themed song. But then we have another guy who's sort of Leonard Cohen-y, but not quite. He's like I don't know if like Leonard Cohen is on this level and Bob Dylan is a couple steps above that. This guy is maybe, he's down at the bottom of the steps, you know, when Milhouse was standing on the steps and Shaft is looking up at him kind of thing. Maybe he's there. But there's a moment which I absolutely love. And it's one of those moments where you watch and go, okay, is this too much or whatever? But when Louise, the guardian angel, takes the raven, although she does do – she takes the raven and leaves Brewster, but then she kills Haskell Weeks. So she does like one more thing on the way out for him, even though she's leaving. And she, which is nice, you know, it's like, oh, this jerk, get rid of him. But the finale, the last moment you see Louise, the guardian angel, is she's walking across the field of the Houston Astrodome. And she's walking to an exit, and the exit is just this huge space with this door wide open, and like a door that lowers, and it's just this huge light. And she walks into the light, fades into the light, the door comes down, and the light goes away. And there's a really great song that plays, something about the last of the unnatural acts.
Right, I John Phillips, by the way. How it's, it John, fits him. It's John Phillips, yes. From the Mamas and the Papas.
Oh, yes, that's – oh, see. Thank you, Ralph. See, I didn't look it up. But I really love that moment in the movie because to me it's like the dome is the space for Brewster. And when your guardian angel walks into the light with her familiar and the light goes out, you are in trouble. And I just love that moment so much. I don't know if it's like – I mean it's one of those moments where it's like, okay, I get it. But it's also – It works in that moment. I think it works really nicely. And because you kind of get like Louise and – well, I like Louise. And I love the fact that Louise is very serious apart from the moments where she's got like a smile on her face. Like she's really – like it's like the bishop's wife, Cary Grant, in that. You know, the moments in The Bishop's Wife when he's helping David Niven and who is the woman in Bishop's Wife?
Loretta Young.
Yes. And he's helping them. And sometimes he's very serious, but then a lot of the times he just has this look on his face like, I am having a hell of a time being an angel. This is really great. And you get that, like, there's a moment where they outwit the big fat security guard where she has a smile on her face. And then during that really weird car chase, she just has a couple of big smiles on her face like, I am having so much fun. And I really like her in this, and I'm saddened when she leaves. And when Brewster is sort of denying her in the end and she begins to make, like, the bird noises, too much. I'm verklempt. It's too much.
There's a couple things before I sort of wrap up here, but that I wanted to mention just because,
sure.
Again, it's occurring to me as I'm looking at it, is I find it always interesting when a particular director can find something in an actor that a lot of other directors kind of can't quite seem to find. And I mean, in this case, we've already talked about Shelley Duvall. There's a scene where she's talking with Brewster, where she's in like a just like a long sleeve shirt with like no pants, and it's red striped.
Yes,
it's very similar to the shirt that he has. He looks like Waldo throughout this whole movie, by the way. He looks exactly like Waldo. But she is unbelievably alluring in those scenes. And yes. And Shelley Duvall, no offense to Miss Duvall, but Shelley Duvall is not really known, I'd say, in a lot of circles as particularly like a sex figure in movies. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. I mean, obviously Sally Kellerman here is very, very sultry, but Shelley Duvall is just, I keep using the words like alluring. She's radiant in this movie. And that's something that Altman saw in her that a lot of other directors really didn't. I mean, her other most famous role is probably from The Shining, and that's completely not
Shining,
that. But I mean, there was something about Altman saw in her that he really was able to put forth. And then with Bud Cort, I can't think of too many actors who had a sort of, I mean, God, here's the metaphor in terms of flying too close to the sun. I mean, burned brighter, but so briefly, because he was in MASH. Mm-hmm. He had a small part in MASH. He's great in that. Of course, he's the private that Burns says, you know, hey, Boone, you killed him. And he gets all upset. And that's what causes Trapper to punch Frank as revenge. But, I mean, he's the lead in this movie. And then he went on to do Harold and Maude, which, of course, put him into the realms of, you know, the immortal. But that was kind of it for him. I mean, he's continued to work, but his two most famous movies were these two movies back to back, and it was something about that he spoke to the moment of 1970, 71, and then not again, and it's sort of tragic because he's really fun in this movie, and of course he's great in Harold and Maude. That's the ultimate role for him. But it's sort of a shame when you see someone who is so good, but so brief. I mean, it's just these two movies, and then it was kind of done.
Yeah, my wife and I were big fans of The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Oh, he's
where
great
he plays
that, yeah.
kind of like the bean counter accounting guy. And he's like, "Hey, isn't this all my equipment? How'd you get this? We effing stole it, man," or whatever it is he says. He's so great in that. And when I first saw Brewster McCloud on Laserdisc back in '96. And I think I read about it in – it was either the magazine or the book Slime Time. I forget the guy who wrote that magazine, but it was a great sort of magazine of cult film, horror film, weird films. And he reviewed Brewster, and his basic review was, "I don't know what's going on, but I loved it." And it was actually one of the first films where I specifically refused to watch it on VHS because I knew the pan and scan version would look like garbage. So I needed to see it in 2.35. And so I had the Laserdisc. I still have it. I have the DVD. Now I have the Blu-ray. And about 5 years ago, like I said, I saw it on the big screen. And it was so much fun. And Sally Kellerman and Bud Cort were there. And they talked about it. And what I remember them saying is they had a great time, and Bud Cort, I'm pretty sure I could be making this up just to justify how much I've talked about this movie in the last hour, but I'm fairly certain Bud Cort said that Robert Altman told him years later that this was one of his favorite films that he'd made. And I can see that, you know. Yeah, I think I had just one or two more. Oh, may I recommend some double features that might be a bit tedious, but you might have fun with.
Absolutely.
So I've got three. Oh, yes, three. I was going to say Brewster McCloud and O.C. and Stiggs because that's what I saw with, and that was a lot of fun. But I'm going to do three of them here. One is if you really like Frank Shaft, and you should, because he's great. And him and Johnson are a great like duo together. And the thing is, like, I think too, like, Frank Shaft's end in the movie is very much because, spoiler, he dies, but he doesn't get strangled. He's sort of the Frank Shaft dream to me is he's this good looking, athletic, kick ass cop who goes out there and saves the day. But during this crazy car chase, and before we go, can we just talk about the car chase for a minute?
right.
I'll do my double features first. But the thing with Shaft to me, yeah, is that you can tell that he's about to die during the car chase because he gets in this kick-ass car and immediately begins getting all smashed up. And you know that as it's getting smashed up, that's not good. That's not why he's there. And then he gets all smashed up and ends his life. And I think for him, he was living his dream. And at the moment where he couldn't live his dream anymore, he decided to leave. And that's a variation on – it's a bit of a sad variation. Most of the variations are sad in this movie, unfortunately, as funny as it is. But three double features. First one, if you like Frank Shaft, you watch – Brewster McCloud, and then followed up with a film from 1984, I believe, called The Dark Side of Midnight. The Dark Side of Midnight is a cop film set in Fort Smith somewhere or other. I'm not sure what the state is. And it's about a bunch of cops trying to solve the Creeper murders. And they can't do it, so they call in an outside guy who's not from San Francisco but goes to San Francisco at the end of the movie. And he shows up, and he's – imagine Frank Shaft – but looking kind of ridiculous with a bad mustache and being completely awkward. That's The Dark Side of Midnight. So
wow.
The Dark Side of Midnight is my favorite. Trauma distributes it. And The Dark Side of Midnight is basically all the guys have bad mustaches. And it is one of the most awkwardly shot and acted movies you'll ever see. And yet it brings me as much joy as Brewster McCloud does. So that might be just me on that one. Second one, Brewster McCloud and my other favorite Bird film, which is Peter Greenaway's The Falls from 10 years later. It came out in 1980. Have you seen The Falls, Rob?
I have not. I as soon as you said Peter Greenaway, I'm like, where's he going with this? Oh, okay. No, I've never seen that one.
Peter Greenaway's The Falls, it was his first feature. He'd made, over the course of the 70s, he made like 7 or 8 shorts. The Falls is a feature. It's, depending upon whether you own the Pell DVD or the NTSC DVD, it's either about 3 hours and 5 minutes or 3 hours and 15 minutes long. It is a fake documentary sort of public information catalog film. And it takes place after something called the Violent Unknown Event, which had something to do with birds. And people are being turned into birds, and there's all sort of ornithological stuff in it. And this, the movie is in 92 segments, and it's alphabetical through all the people in this who have been affected by this event, whose surname begins with Falls. And it's one of the weirdest films you'll ever watch. Possibly. And don't watch it with Brewster, Rob. Your head might go, psh. It's crazy. And I absolutely adore it. And it more so than Brewster is a film that you'll sit there going, what? What? Because it just piles up. Because it's like a fake encyclopedia. So it just piles up these mini biographies of 92 people. And they begin to intertwine by the end. And it's crazy. But I have two bird films I love, this one and The Falls. Now, yes, I'm also a big fan of Beaks, the movie. I am also a big fan of The Birds. But these two are my favorites. So that's the second one. And the third one is actually a slightly weird one. This is a location-based one. And this is the second feature is not a movie. If you love looking at the Houston Astrodome with its 4,596 acrylic sheet skylights, which are 7 feet each, you should go to – this is out on DVD. Game 6 of the National League Championship Series from 1986, October 15th, 1986, New York Mets versus the Houston Astros. It, I don't know. I it is an incredible game. Do you know the game? Do you know the 86 series?
Of Rob, course I do Mets not.
And the So Game 6 is – it's the New York Mets. It's the Houston Astros. It went 16 innings. It's an incredible game, and it's in the Astrodome. So you're constantly seeing all the space that Brewster is in, but used how it's supposed to be used rather than making a wacky movie. So that's if you can stand some baseball, and there are days where I certainly can, I would say that's a second feature. So that's that.
Wow.
And I'll stop there, Rob, and just – I will just ask you one – I'll just ask, what did you think of that car chase? And then we can wrap it up. I'm sorry. I'm going all over here.
No, I mean, well, it's a great car chase. And I think it's very funny that in the trailer, which you mentioned earlier, like how much of that is the car chase? Because clearly the studio was like, well, people like car chases. Maybe they'll like this. I mean, they're clearly trying to like get the audience something that they can sink their teeth into. It's like, oh, people like car chases.
Yes.
And by the way, now that you've mentioned the Houston Astrodome, I do have to – this will be the last thing I have to mention. If you go to the IMDb trivia page for this film, you know, you'll notice some films, obviously, that are very famous have, like, long trivia sections because there's been a lot of people that have come by and have quoted, you know, put stuff about it. And some of them are often very repetitive, and it's clearly not edited by anybody in particular because they're not paying attention that, you know, this trivia was already mentioned 5 posts up. But good Lord – if you go to the trivia page for the Brewster McCloud, there is so much information about downtown Houston and only stuff that only people that live in Houston could possibly care about. It makes me think that some guy from the Houston Chamber of Commerce got an IMDb account and just decided, because it's like, well, if you go down to the if you look at 2832 when Brewster makes a right turn, he goes down by the cafe, which is no longer there, by the way. You go down 4 blocks and you go into Frank's Cleaners, and you're like, who the F cares about all this stuff about Houston? But clearly, if you are a Houston native, like, this is your movie. Like, you are just so proud of it because it is all about your city.
Yes, yeah, and. And I will say, just with the car chase, the thing I love about the car chase is that he rarely ever, like, does, like, gets on the ground, like in a car, like following everyone. Almost so much of it is just like he seems to be in a helicopter and a crane, like looking down
right.
as these yeah. sort of choreographed things happen, which is almost the antithesis of what a car chase is.
Right.
Obviously, we had the bullet car chase and French Connection wouldn't be for a year or two. But you had – if you go back in time and you do like – well, it isn't car chase, but there's a Harold Lloyd film called Girl Shy that has some crazy chasing through the street stuff in it. And the whole time you're on the street as he's doing this crazy stuff. And this is specifically like Robert Altman going, we'll be up here. You know, there's even this point where I guess my two favorite moments, there's a point where everyone kind of like does a jump into an intersection and they're going super fast. And then all of a sudden the White Feathered Wings song begins playing instrumentally and it becomes slow motion. And it's just the cars going slow-mo. And it's like, I don't know what he's doing, but I love it. And there's a scene where they all go across a railroad track. And it's like bluegrass music plays as they're all bouncing along the railroad track. But then when Louise, the guardian angel, her car goes on the track, it just sails right along the top of the track. So it's a really weird car chase that I just love to bits, because it's like a guy who I never think of for directing action, just having fun with it and just doing his own version of it. So it's I wouldn't put it like in, you know, your top tier car chases, but I would put it somewhere where it's a lot of fun.
I'm trying to picture like that footage going back to the studio and probably get these old hands going, what the hell is this guy shooting? Like, what is he doing? This is not what this is supposed to be. Doesn't he know how to shoot a car chase? What's going on?
Because there's some great choreography, because throughout the whole thing, Louise's little red car, which I should probably know the name of, is constantly getting in the way of things. And you can just see when it's overhead, you can see like the way they've got it all mapped out. And it's really lovely. It's not like it ain't Bullet. It ain't the French Connection. You know, it ain't Ronin. You know, it's kind of silly and almost like you wanted a car chase. Here, I'm in a helicopter. Watch these cars. And I kind of like that.
Yeah, it's a truly unique movie, and like I said, I want to watch it again. I mean, I said Altman in the 70s. I think I've seen virtually every Altman 70s movie except for Health. I think I've never managed to find Health anywhere
Anywhere. Same here.
Good Lord! I mean, he was one of the great geniuses. And anytime someone, to me, the follow up films after someone's mega success are in many ways the most interesting, because it is that blank check. It's whether it's the Magnificent Ambersons, or in even some ways kind of like the Close Encounters in some bizarre. I mean, something where a director is just given free rein after they have a massive success, and then this is definitely one of the great examples of just a director just letting it rip. And it's really very interesting. And so, like I said, I was a little scared to do the show because I just don't like letting everybody know on a podcast that I am choosing to edit and publish and put out on the world that I'm kind of dumb when it comes to this stuff. But I would only do it with you, Dan, because you are like the coolest film instructor I will never have. And so I very much appreciate you coming on and talking this through me, because now I want to give the movie another shot, but with your voice in my head.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it is one of those films where you really watch it once and you get one sort of feel for it, and then you watch it again, and if you're in a different frame of mind, it feels like a different film almost. And you can see things and grab things that you didn't the first time, and you can it's like Ingmar Bergman's The Silence. I've watched The Silence four times. Every time I watch it, I have a completely different concept of what happened in the movie. Brewster, every time I watch it, there's something where I go, oh, like the guy with the jail guy with the cigarettes. I'd never seen that. That had never occurred to me before. But now I'm convinced it's true. It's probably baloney, but I'm convinced it's true. So it's one of those films to come back to.
Absolutely. And I simply love the fact that while we're discussing Brewster McCloud, you have managed to mention The Bishop's Wife and Ingmar Bergman's The Silence. That is just, you do not disappoint, Dan. Yeah. You really do not. So
thank you, Rob.
Where can people find you on the internet?
The best place to go for my podcast is eventuallysupertrain.blogspot.com. That has my short-lived TV show, Eventually Supertrain, which ages ago Rob was on, and we did some very spirited discussions of Police Squad.
Oh, that was so much fun.
Which is a glorious show. Oh, that was super fun. Right now we are discussing – I am discussing The Last Precinct, which is a Stephen J. Cannell Police Academy S show from 86. I'm discussing with my friend Amy the Conqueror a show called Erie, Indiana from 91. And my friend Gore Blimey in Wales and I are discussing 2006's the follow-up to Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, a show called Man to Man with Dean Lerner. And also on that site, you'll find links to my other podcasts, Dan's Driving Double Feature, where I talk double features. And I'm currently doing 1 minute with European Zombies, circa 1980, where I'm talking. And I'm up to minute 25 of Zombie Lake and Burial Ground, which is – and I'm having a great time. And the other big podcast I'm on, because I'm on a podcast called Podcast Mania, which is basically a bunch of friends and myself talking about horror movies and heavy metal and things. But I'm also on a podcast with the great Amanda Reyes and Nathan Johnson, Made for TV Mayhem show, which was nominated for a Rondo. So if anyone's listening and you vote for the Rondo Awards, vote for Made for TV Mayhem.
I did. I voted for it. I sent my ballot in two days ago.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. So those are the podcasts. And I have a site called Some Polish American Guy Reviews Things, which has some of my writing. I used to write for a site called Bleeding Skull, which has some of my writing. And if you go on like Amazon and look up Daniel Budnick or Dan Budnick, the books that aren't photography related are mine. There are two of them. One's on action films, one's on horror films. So there's stuff all over.
Absolutely. I'll have the link to the Eventually Supertrain in the show notes, of course. Like I said,
thank you.
I always love talking to you, Dan, and so this has been a blast.
Oh, yeah.
I want to dig up these other movies you're talking about, and even that baseball game I'm just kind of curious about, too. So, of course, everybody –
it's a good game. It's a really good game.
I'm sure it is. So, of course, if you want to listen to back episodes of the show, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes and on Stitcher, or go to the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're always talking movies over on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Go check out Brewster McCloud. It's on Amazon Prime, which is where I watched it. So if you have that, you can watch it for free. Go check it out over there. And if not, give it a rental. It's certainly not everybody's cup of tea, but it's well worth watching. Very interesting movie. And you know, you got to pursue your dreams, man. So again, thanks everybody for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Aren't you gonna kiss me?
I don't know how.
Brewster, are you a virgin?
Am I a virgin?
I bet you live with your mother, don't you?
No, I live by myself.
Where?
By the dome, in a room. I gotta get going. It'll take me a while to get back.
Oh, look, take my car. I can get a ride with Nikki. She works at the dome, too. You can meet me there at 4 o'clock, and I'll get my car then. How's that for a good plan?
Okay.
That way I'll get to see you tomorrow. Goodbye. Don't forget 4 o'clock.
Hey, boy. Where the hell you think you're going with that car?
Pardon me?
Pardon me, my ass. That car belongs to Billy Joe Goodwill, and that happens to be me, and I've been chasing you down for a long time.
I think you've made an error.
There's been a goddamn error made, all right, but you and that dingy girlfriend of yours are the one that made the error, and now I'm fixed to strung your head, and when I get through with you, I'm gonna go up to...